Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
If you know anything, or if you know anybody who knows anything, even just a little stuff will help. Or just handing out flyers, or if you see like a post on Facebook that brings up my brother, just keep sharing it as much as you can. Because anything, even just the little things, would make a big difference.
You know, I miss my best friend and his family's. They're heartbroken over it, same as I am. I don't want to give up hope on him. I certainly still hope he's alive. He wasn't really the type of guy to ask people for help. He'd be more likely to offer people help. I could see him ending up in the river, you know, if a drunk driver slammed into him and, like, catapulted his body into the river. I could see that, but, you know, him getting drunk and falling off of the trail, I just don't see that. And people regularly fish that river.
On the evening of November 3rd, 2018, 28-year-old James Lidka and his roommate joined some friends on a popular street in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, for a night of celebrating a friend's birthday. In the early morning hours of November 4th, James was last seen on surveillance video walking behind a local bar. That camera footage is the last known sighting of James. He never made it home and was never seen or heard from again. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 176 of The Vanished, James Lidka's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. At the time of his disappearance, James Lidka was only 28 years old. He had already served in the United States Army and returned from a deployment in Afghanistan. He was an engineering student and enjoyed being back at home. For this story, we spoke with his aunt Valerie. She shared what she remembers of James's childhood.
James as a child was kind of a little stinker. They had Kristen first and then James, and those are the only two kids. So James with Kristen, they grew up very close. He's kind of a jokester. He loves the outdoors, likes to fish. So he likes to play video games, but I'd say he's kind of just your typical all-American Midwestern guy growing up, you know, very family-oriented. You know, he was in the service, he was active duty, came back and joined the Guards for a time as well. His dad, lifetime military as well, so he kind of falls in Jim's footsteps, you know, as far as that goes. But he'd recently gotten out of the service, and now, you know, he was going to the UW Stout program. But just the kind of person that would do, if you called him and you needed help, he would be the guy to be there for you. You know, just a reliable, good kid.
James's sister Kristen also spoke with us. At the time of his disappearance, James and Kristen were living together. She told us that they often spent their free time playing video games and watching movies.
We pretty much, when we spend time together, most of the time we're just talking and just having a conversation with each other. I do play some video games. He plays video games, and he always makes fun of me playing video games. But, you know, we talk about stuff like that or do stuff like that together, too, I guess. We have gone to, like, the movies, same interest, though one of them, at one point, he decided he didn't want to watch movies with me because of it reminded him of when he was overseas. The context of the movie, it was the American Hero, I think, or Soldier, or I forgot, but it was about Chris Kyle. I actually didn't even know it was a true story, and neither did he. For a short period, we didn't see a movie together.
While James and Kristen were close growing up, James also had a close friend, Cody, that he met at school when they were just kids. James and Cody remained close as they grew up. And when James decided to join the Army, Cody went into the Air Force, inspired by James's decision to serve his country. Cody told us why he and James became fast friends.
My mom and I kind of bounced around a lot when I was younger, and we ended up in Nilsville, Wisconsin, which is mine and James's hometown. Can't remember exactly how old I was. I remember I was in third grade when I first met him. Yeah, that's kind of how James and I became friends. You know, but between the two of us, like, he was the bad cop, I was the good cop, that kind of thing. Always getting into trouble. I mean, not like super serious trouble, but yeah, you know, just being like devious little kids. We always had each other's back, that's for sure. So James always wanted to be in the Army. At least while we were growing up, that was the only thing that he wanted to do. Whenever, like, bullies and stuff came around at school, like, he'd always be the one to, like, tell them to go screw themselves. He'd always be the one to, like, stand up to them. Or, like, whenever someone tried messing with me, he'd always be like, hey, you need to leave him alone. He always kind of had, like, that, you know, stand up to bad guy mentality. I joined myself in the Air Force mainly because, like, you know, James wanted to join. You know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life at the time. And I was like, well, my best friend's going to join, and I'm going to join too. So I ended up joining the Air Force, and he ended up becoming infantry in the Army. I was stationed in Qatar at a base called IUD for a couple of weeks, and then I ended up in a country called the United Arab Emirates for a couple of months. But I didn't see anything crazy like James did.
Cody said that he feels very fortunate to have had a relatively safe deployment without any of the horror stories we hear so often from returning veterans. When we spoke with Cody, he said that while James returned from the war physically unharmed, he had some traumatic experiences that left him with emotional scars. Cody shared one experience that James was continuing to heal from.
So I have a handful of friends that have seen action, and James being one of them. They've all, you know, whenever they had a traumatic experience out in the desert, I've only ever heard them tell me those stories one time. And that was the case with James. I kind of remember the year it happened. I don't remember exactly which month, but in I want to say it was 2012. I was getting ready to go to Qatar in the UAE at the time. And James had called me, and he was telling me about this story, something that had happened to him recently at the time. I guess him and all of his buddies were out on some kind of convoy or just driving around, scoping out the local area. They had pulled over to stop, and some nut job came bursting out of a hut or a house or something, just like shooting at them. I don't think anyone got killed from it, but I remember James told me the feeling that he had from that day. He thought for sure that all of his friends were dead, but turned out everyone was okay. But I know he was never quite the same after that. I mean, I don't think it, you know, would cause him to like kill himself or anything, but I know he was just not the same person that he was before that. I don't know if he got an official diagnosis from the VA, but yeah, I have friends that have PTSD myself, and James definitely had PTSD. You know, James, he'd always want to try and like take care of his problems by himself. He wasn't really the type of guy to ask people for help.
At the time that James was deployed to Afghanistan with the Army, His father was also stationed in the same area. The Lidka family is a military family, and this is a source of pride for them. We asked Valerie to tell us more about this.
He joined the army. Him and his dad actually were both stationed together. They were both over there at the same time. Has a lot of friends that are in the service. My brother was in Desert Storm as well, so it's kind of amazing. I mean, we do have military that kind of runs through our bloodlines. Our father was in the service, cousins. I have two kids that are now, one's in the Air National Guard, one's in the Army National Guard. So it's something that kind of runs through our family.
We also asked James's sister, Kristen, about his decision to go into the military.
James joined the Army, and he got stationed in Afghanistan. The same time Dad got stationed in Afghanistan, and for a few years he was stationed in Kentucky, I think it is. So we were like separated, and then when he moved back to Wisconsin, we lived together. We were like back together again for like 5 years until he went missing. Right away out of high school, he was in the Army. And when he came back, he didn't go to school right away. He went to Kurt Manufacturing for about 3 years. And then he worked somewhere else for like a few months and then went to college. This would have been his second year in college.
On the night that he disappeared, James had joined his roommate Mai and some of her friends for a birthday celebration for another friend. They left that evening, got on a party bus, and headed down to a popular part of Eau Claire, where many college-age kids go to gather on the weekends. James's sister Kristen did not go out with Mai and James that evening, but she shared what she knows of the events leading up to the decision to go out.
I remember I ran into the roommate, Mai, and she told me that she was going out. I never knew about my brother going out, too. The next day, which was Sunday, she randomly texted me and asking me if my brother was here. And I said no, because I just thought, oh, he's in at his other place, which he was renting in Menominee. And she said that he was out with her and at the, I guess, birthday party get together for the bars with her friends, because the only friend that was his was Mai. Everybody else, they may have like talked to him a few times because I guess it was all her friends from work.
Eventually, it got late and James hadn't returned home. Kristen found this strange, but thought maybe James had crashed at a friend's house or another place he rented in a nearby town. So she decided to text him and make sure he was okay.
I texted James a few times. He never replied back. I texted Dad telling him that James won't reply back like a little kid. Because, you know, if I don't say something, at least, you know, if Dad gets an answer, at least I know, you know, he's okay. Dad never got a reply. Dad and I was pretty much both thinking maybe he's out with some girl, you know. Well, Monday I looked around, drove around, and I couldn't find him. And then Tuesday I went to Menominee and we couldn't find him. So when I told Dad, Dad left work right away. And he also stopped at the same spots I did, looking for my brother while heading home and telling Mom, because neither one of us wanted to worry Mom. So the only two people besides Mai that knew all about this was Mai, me, and Dad, because Dad also didn't want to worry Mom. That's why I always go to Dad. It's easier to go to Dad because I don't want Mom to worry. It's not that I want to hide anything from her. I don't want her to worry. When Monday was ending and still not hearing anything, and then the beginning of Tuesday, because I know I had to do something early in the morning that Tuesday, and then before I went to work, I went to go look a little more, but in a different town, seeing maybe if he is there, he just is busy, you know, but he wasn't there. If he texts me, sometimes it might be like a couple hours later, but he does reply. He doesn't always reply right away, but to be like an hour or two, and I'll still at least get something, and I wasn't getting anything. And it's same with Dad. Like, if Dad texts, not always right away. Sometimes it's right away. Sometimes you're busy and you can't reply right away. So Dad came back Tuesday. So yeah, Wednesday, I actually started seeing posts all over Facebook by my relatives. And that's when I'm guess Dad must have talked to the police also. All I remember is that I was at work Wednesday. Both my parents came up just so we could be together before I went to work. I was going to work Thursday and have Friday off at work. I couldn't focus because I cried so much that they gave me the day off. And I remember the police was here for a little bit. They talked to my dad. I remember we went out for a little bit with my cousin and my dad's sister and like a few other, I think they were veterans. They did a little search with us as well. That Thursday, it was also on the news, and that was like the only time once that day where they put it on the news. And after that, it was like not on the news again until like the last couple weeks, months, since they finally started putting it back on the news. And it was more the missing young lady and this other guy who was missing a day after my brother. Those guys were repeatedly on the news where my brother was like finally starting now to get back on the news. And it's like, he's been missing for a while. I mean, wouldn't you want to put him on the news a little more?
Kristen never got a response from James. So she called their father, and he came into Eau Claire, and they began to drive around town and look for James on their own. As the weekend wore on, and she and her father still hadn't found any indication of James, Kristen decided to contact Mai and ask her if she remembered seeing or hearing anything that may have been important.
I don't remember exactly which day it was, but I had asked her a few questions. Since she lives here, I wanted to know what went on that night, you know? And instead of just answering my questions, she told me to ask the police officers. It's like, they weren't the last people to see my brother. You were. You live here. You know? At the beginning, it made me feel like she was just hiding things. It's like, why can't you just tell me? Answer my questions. You live here. That's my brother. Say is your friend. I mean, you'd think if you cared about the family, you would answer questions that, you know, but there's some days where I want to just blame it all on her, but I can't, because as much as she pushed him to go out, he still made the choice. I just know that she should have answered my questions instead of making me ask police officers when really she was the last person to be with him. You know what I mean? We don't really talk. She doesn't really talk much to me at all. Like the recent messages, because I know she up and left the house on January 23rd. And then it gave her a few days to come back in until I changed the locks on the doors. She was not happy about it, but it's like, you moved out. You also never told me you were moving out.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. With little helpful information from Mai and no sightings of James, Kristen and James's father Jim started to notify other family members via text. When we spoke to his aunt Valerie, we asked her to share how she came to find out that James was missing. This is what she had to say.
I came home from work and had gotten thrown in a family messenger. My brother made a messenger chat room with all of the family and just told us all together that James had been missing since Saturday and that he hasn't been in contact with anybody, that they've been up here looking and they've contacted the police and whatnot. So he did it that way, so he wasn't messaging a whole bunch of different people. Immediately, we reached out to, I think, Wisconsin Rapids Search and Rescue to get a missing persons flyer made of James and to start circulating the information as best as we can with social media, you know, to try to get that information out there. Kristen wasn't with James. Kristen was at the house that night. Her and her brother lived together, and when James, Mai actually lived there too. So as far as I knew, James didn't want to go out that night, but Mai talked him into going. So Kristen just knew where he was going and who he was going with. And then I don't think it was until the next day, Mai started saying, you know, James is missing, James is missing. And then, of course, it went through the family that way. Kristen got a hold of Jim.
James's childhood friend Cody doesn't live in Eau Claire or even Wisconsin, but has been trying to help with the search for James as much as he can from out of state. Cody told us how he found out that his friend was missing.
I got the phone call from his dad, Jim. Jim asked me if I had talked to him recently and said no. And he was like, well, James is missing. And James has never been the type of person to run away from something. So it was just very unusual, you know, that Jim would be calling me about something like that, unless if it was serious. So I took it very seriously as soon as Jim talked to me about it. And just tried my best to, like, stay in the loop with the family, try to keep up to date with anything that they might have found out. I did some Google searching on, you know, things that I could do to help. So I opened a case with Namus on his behalf, just so that I thought at the time, like, if I opened a case for him through Namus, I'd be able to, like, see updates from law enforcement or search and rescue and things like that. But yeah, that definitely was not the case.
At the time of James's disappearance, he had been sharing a house with his sister Kristen and a young woman named Mai, who he had met in town and who had expressed a need for a place to live. Valerie isn't certain how James met Mai, but this is what she shared about how Mai came to live with James and Kristen.
From what I understand, it was that Mai was somehow going to become homeless. What the circumstances of that is, I'm not entirely sure. But she was losing where she had been living and needed a place to stay. And, of course, James offered her to rent one of the rooms from him. So she moved in, I believe it was last late summer, and then she moved into the house.
Since James and Kristen shared a home, I thought Kristen may know more about Mai or be aware of how she came to be their roommate. This is what she shared about Mai.
I actually do not know how he met Mai. All I know is, I think what he told me, and I'm not 100% sure, but I think he said he met her at a bar. He was kind of picking on her a little bit, and then they became friends. After one of my friends moved out, she needed a place to stay, so he let her move in and rent a room.
When James didn't return that night, his roommate Mai called James's dad, Jim, the next morning.
Mai did contact my brother, Jim, and said that James is missing. And my brother told me that initially he wasn't very worried about it because he was kind of like, well, Mai kind of is, how do I want to put this? She texts him a lot, like she was overbearing kind of. Jim just thought he wasn't answering Mai because he was just kind of tired of her texting him or something along those lines. So that's why my brother wasn't really worried about it initially until it came another day. And now still nobody knows where James is. And James, my brother and Kristen too, very close, all texting each other a lot and talking to each other almost daily. So yeah, that's kind of how it went. Initially, it was more like, well, he's just avoiding Mai. And then it came to be quite clear he wasn't coming home. He hadn't been home, hadn't gotten his car, nothing.
While I was researching this case, Mai seemed like an elusive character that no one seemed to know much about. We did reach out to her to see if she'd like to do an interview, but we never heard back from her. We thought that maybe someone James would have confided in, like his friend Cody, would know more, so we asked him what he knew about Mai.
At least the way that it was told to me, she, I guess, was kind of down on her luck, didn't really have a place of her own. James offered to let her stay at his house while he was going to school at Stout. He ended up getting an apartment at Menominee, but that's the extent of my knowledge on that. He made like a very vague reference to her the last time I saw him in October. He had like very loosely mentioned about her, but he never told me her name or anything like that. I didn't know who she was until he went missing.
I was curious to know if James and Mai were dating, and James just hadn't shared that information with family yet.
I don't really know. I remember the last time that I saw him, he had mentioned that there was a girl that he was interested in and a girl that he wanted to date, but she ended up getting a boyfriend. I don't necessarily know if that's Mai, but I do remember there was someone that he was romantically interested in before he went missing.
James's Aunt Valerie has been leading the family's search for him. We asked her to share some of the things that they've learned and also what they're doing to search for him.
We do know that his vehicle has never moved. He's never gone back to his classes, never went back to his house, never touched any of his bank accounts. In the one media release, they said that his phone, he was seen last 1:13 a.m. behind the pickle. And then his phone took an incoming call, I think it was like at 8:30 that night. We don't really know if that was a text or a phone call. We've never really known or who it was from or anything like that. But for it to still pick up on in his voicemail leads us to believe that, you know, it was still able to take incoming calls, kind of the way that they worded it. His phone last pinged down here on Menominee Street in Eau Claire, which is pretty close to the Chippewa River, which is about a block away. So we don't really know what happened from then on. There has been actually several searches. There's been several different rapid search and rescue. Bruce's Legacy are a couple that I can think of off the top of my head that were here initially. When James went missing and did do a search of this end of the Chippewa, and they went quite a ways downriver, but nothing was ever found. His phone was never found. The cap he was wearing was never found. There's never been anything for us to say 100% he's in the river. What we're doing today is a flyer campaign in Wisconsin right now. There's still a foot or so of snow on the ground. The river's up quite a bit from melting snow. There's flooding downriver, so it's not really safe for anybody to go out in these kind of conditions at this time. So what we're doing is sending people out into all different areas here in Eau Claire, getting James's picture out, letting people know he's still missing. Once the weather gets nicer and people do get out and about, look in your sheds that aren't open, you know, that you don't use all the time. If you've got property that you don't usually use or something, just make sure that you're checking and making sure that people realize that he's still out there and we're still looking for him. So to raise awareness, you know, we're going out to businesses and homes and neighborhoods and getting his flyers out. Right now, it's a beautiful day. It's sunny out. It's supposed to be almost 50 today. It's a gorgeous day, but there's still quite a bit of mud and flooding and snow. So it's kind of nasty. The Chippewa is pretty much unfrozen right now. It's got a pretty strong current, but it's still up. And I know downriver, the boat landings and whatnot are flooded. So getting people into boats out on the river right now, probably not going to be for a couple few weeks yet, where everything's going to get melted and settled down, where, you know, you're not so worried about safety going back out onto the river to do some more searches. Right now, the water temperature is just too cold. I mean, we definitely plan on, when it gets nicer out, kayaking the area, sending people out canoes, airboats, that sort of thing. But that's going to have to wait just a little bit longer yet. Spring's not quite here in Wisconsin, unfortunately.
So the night that James went missing, the group he was with arrived on Water Street and separated, going to different bars, including the Pioneer and Shenanigans. Later, James, by himself at this point, attempted to enter a bar called the Pickle, but was refused entry because he appeared to be intoxicated. Police reviewed surveillance videos from different businesses in the area. They were able to determine that he was last seen on surveillance video walking behind the Pickle at 1:13 a.m., going in the direction of a bike path. The police department has released some information about the activity on James's phone. The last communication he had with anyone from the party was at 12:25 a.m. on the 4th. His phone last pinged on Menominee Street, which is not far from the river. So James was last seen at 1:13 a.m. on the 4th, and the last activity on his phone was at 8:25 p.m. that night, more than 19 hours later. This could have been an incoming call or text. After that, it appears the phone was shut off or the battery died. It was mentioned earlier that James had a home in Eau Claire and an apartment in Menominee. He stayed at that apartment while attending classes at UW-Stout. He never returned to either residence or moved his vehicle. Another man disappeared around the same time as James. The family's searches collided, but the other man has since been found.
There was a gentleman that they were searching for at the same time they were searching for James. Toby Cleasy went missing a couple days after James did. And when they were doing one of the searches up here, they told me that they were also looking for Toby and that they were pretty sure that Toby was a suicide because he had stage 4 cancer and his car was found somewhere near a waterway. But Toby wasn't found in the river. Toby was actually found deceased in a house in December. And they sent him away for toxicology reports and all that sort of thing. But nothing's been released to the public ever since what the circumstances of Toby's death was. And I know personally, I just talked to Toby's mom, and Toby didn't have stage 4 cancer. So why they said that or where they came up with that, we don't really have any idea. It's kind of a mystery. And that's another reason that gives me pause, because of James, you know, they were pretty sure Toby was in the river, but he wasn't in the river. So they say they know they don't suspect foul play, but we still don't know what happened to Toby. Like, how can you not kind of think about one without thinking about the other? And the people that are helping me today with the flyer campaign, I have Toby Cleasby's family is here helping us, who just went through losing Toby, and they're wonderful, giving people who want to help us. We have Brendan Felton's family here. Brendan Felton was also one of the gentlemen that went missing here the same year he was found in the river. So there's some just amazing people that I've met that want to help us, and we're all feel like family with each other now, you know, because when you go through this, it's just amazing. Like, I'm just amazed at how giving these families are and how understanding and, you know, how they can give back once they've gone through all of this pain, you know. Pretty phenomenal people.
Wisconsin has a notification system for missing veterans who may be in danger. However, James did not meet the criteria for a green alert to be issued. When we spoke to Valerie, she shared some of her frustrations with the current Green Alert system and how she hopes to work to have it serve veterans more effectively in the future.
We weren't able to get them to process a green alert when he went missing, because on a green alert, they have to have some sort of ailment left over from being in the service in order to get, like, they're suicidal or that kind of thing. James didn't fit any of those qualifications for them to put out the green alert for him. I don't 100% agree with what parameters they are putting on that requirement. I think if you're a veteran and you're missing, there needs to be an alert. If you're going to say, was he on medication or did he tell you he was suicidal, that kind of thing, you don't know what's inside somebody's head. You don't know what somebody's thinking. So I think it would be better off just to be able to, you know, put out that green alert right away. You know, I've lost people in my life before that I would never think would take their own life or something along those lines. So you really can't be the one to judge that. I think it's great we have Amber Alerts. I think it's great we have Silver Alerts. And I think that the green alert is an awesome thing, too. It just needs a little tweaking to make sure that it's going to be as beneficial as possible.
We also know that James was at a birthday celebration on the night that he disappeared, and that the surveillance video that is the last known sighting of him appears to show him being denied entry to a bar. Valerie would also like to work on increasing awareness in the area where James was drinking, bringing more volunteers and designated drivers to that area that can ensure people make it to their destination safely. This is what she had to say.
The unfortunate facts about it is, in Wisconsin, out of the top 20 drinkingest cities in America, Wisconsin has 7 of them. You know, that's a lot. We need to start thinking about our culture, how we can change kind of the thought process. What I'm thinking, you know, out of all of this that's happened, our ultimate goal is to bring James home safely. My secondary goal here is, with the amount of missing that we have in Wisconsin, we have to start doing something better. You know, in the instance of James, if he was too intoxicated to enter that bar, and those guys knew he was too intoxicated to enter that bar, if that were to happen, I think that there should be a safe ride home program for those people. You can't say you can't get in here and then just let them wander off if you're taking the responsibility to stop them from entering your establishment because they're too intoxicated. Then they need a safe ride home. Something, we need to set up some sort of a safety net there, in my opinion. And James wasn't driving that night, which I'm grateful for. If you can recognize he's too intoxicated to get in your bar, then we need to take that next step. Even if you're calling 911 and getting him arrested for public intox, at least you're pulling him off of the street and he's less likely to go wander off somewhere and nobody knows where he's at. That's one of my goals. And in La Crosse, Wisconsin, they used to have this kind of same thing. The drinking, all of the taverns that are in that town and bars that are in that town are so close to the river. And they were having a lot of that happening where people were intoxicated and they walked into the river or whatever happened, what they did is they instilled what they call the River Watch Program. And it's a volunteer program and it gets people out, volunteers out on the weekends by the river, watching out for people, you know. And I know on their website, according to them, that they've intervened with quite a few people disoriented by the river. They thought the river was a parking lot. You can read about it on their webpage. And it's really helped to curb the problem that they were having there too, where they were losing one or, you know, a person a year to what they call a staggered pass.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. You heard me mention at the beginning of the episode that James and Cody have been friends since childhood, and that they've been through so much together. Cody would know as well as anyone what may have happened to James. So we asked him what he thinks happened that night.
It's just really hard for me to say. The Falling in the River theory is the only one that's really stuck so far. You know, I actually had a very similar experience like that myself. Couple of years ago when I was in Japan. So I ended up that night with like a tree branch in my leg and third degree burns on the wound from trying to cauterize it. James and I are very similar in that regard. Like if we end up in near death situations, like we're going to do whatever we can to live. You know, James has the same self-aid and buddy care training that I did when I was in the military. So, like, if something like that did happen to him, I have no question that he would be able to take care of himself. At least the circumstances surrounding his disappearance, really the only one that makes sense to me is James being dead. I wish I could have, like, a positive outlook on that, but that's really the only one that makes sense. Like, he would never give up on his friends. You know, he would never abandon his family. He wouldn't just up and walk away from everything. Like, he'd be more inclined to do the opposite.
Earlier in the episode, Cody discussed some of the traumatic experiences James had experienced while deployed with the Army in Afghanistan. While he did say that to his knowledge, James had never been diagnosed with PTSD, he did express some concern that James would have probably preferred to handle things on his own. Is it possible that he chose to harm himself that night?
I really don't know. It's hard to say, but I don't think so. I've been in a situation like that myself, and at least the last time that I talked to him, like he wasn't showing any of the signs of depression or anything like that. Don't get me wrong, James has made some poor decisions. I don't think he would get so drunk that he would end up having an accident. Like, you know, we've gone to parties together, you know, in high school. I don't think I've ever seen James blackout drunk. I mean, I've seen him like happy giggly drunk, but I've never seen him past the point where he wasn't able to control himself. I saw the camera photo of the last time that he was seen. He'd be more likely to tell a bouncer to go, you know, F himself and then just walk away and go somewhere else. Just looking at his body language from that last photo, it looked like he was really either pissed off about something or stressed about something. Because I've seen him get in a fight before. And, you know, he's got like that chest out, like holding his gut, right hand's kind of stressed in that photo. I don't know. I think he might have been in some kind of bar fight beforehand, but I don't know for certain.
When James's family reached out and asked us to cover his story, I wanted to shine a light on something that affects so many Americans in the post-September 11th world, We don't know if James had PTSD or if it's even relevant to his disappearance, but we do know that it's something that many veterans returning to civilian life struggle with. We can all think of someone we know and love who is living with post-traumatic stress disorder. Of course, PTSD is not limited to those who have been in combat, but many of those who do face its challenges have been to war. It's so important for us to understand what PTSD is, what it looks like, and who it affects. So I wanted to bring on an expert to help better understand the complexities of this issue.
My full name is Elspeth Cameron Ritchie. I'm a psychiatrist. I was a psychiatrist in the Army for almost 30 years, retiring from the Army in 2010. And one of my specialties is post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and I've written extensively on the topic. I was in the Army as a psychiatrist, and PTSD has always been a diagnosis that military psychiatrists see. 9/11 happened, and we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And since then, we've had hundreds of thousands of troops of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. So when I was on active duty, I was very involved in policies to try to screen for PTSD and to try to treat it. And since retiring from the military, I've written several books and numerous articles on the topic. And as you may or may not be aware, PTSD has other disorders that go with it, what we call comorbidities, and it's closely linked with depression, with substance abuse, and with suicide. And so all of those topics run together.
In researching PTSD, I learned that it has several terms, and there is some disagreement about the terminology that's currently being used, how it's changed, and how it's defined now.
So there is a debate about that topic. There are certainly those who are advocating that we use the term either post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic growth, and that we do not call it a disorder. And I can see the reason for that, because calling it a disorder stigmatizes those who have it. Having said that, there's also some other complications. Many in the veteran community are worried that if we don't call it PTSD, if we call it PTS, that there will stop being disability payments for it, and they're concerned with losing their benefits. There is also a group that says there's a lot of growing that people do in combat, and I agree. So they call it post-traumatic growth. But I think that what we don't want to do is diminish how severe PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, can be. We don't want to minimize the effect that it has on veterans and their families.
We often hear about people who have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress after a variety of traumas, not only war. I wanted to know what the definition of post-traumatic stress is and what the criteria entails. Dr. Ritchie gave us a comprehensive definition that I think really helps us understand what it means to have this kind of condition.
So post-traumatic stress disorder is characterized by exposure to an extreme stressor. And then there's a number of different symptoms that fall into several main categories. One of those categories is hyperarousal, a fight or flight. So you startle easily, you have intrusive memories. Another category is actually a disassociation, a depersonalization, so that you feel numb and you don't want to talk to anybody. And then the diagnosis was actually updated about 3 years ago, and there's new components to it. One is physical reactions. So, for example, you smell the smell of burning meat at a grill, and it takes you back to the night in Baghdad when you got mortared and one of your buddies died, burned alive in the car, and you have a physical reaction so that you might feel nauseous. It's also accompanied by sleep problems and irritability. And the interested reader can Google PTSD. There's a lot of research at the National Center for PTSD, and so they can get the complete definition, all the different criteria, and there are many different criteria for it. PTSD is unique from other psychiatric disorders in a couple ways. One is it's caused by trauma. So it's not something you're born with. So people think of it as an environmental. People get triggered. By trigger, there can be triggers of smells, sounds, sights. A common one for Vietnam veterans is to hear a helicopter because that reminds them of the choppers overhead in Vietnam.
With this definition and terminology in mind, I wanted to know what someone with PTSD looks like. Can you look at someone and know they have post-traumatic stress from a physical symptom? Or is it entirely psychological? We asked Dr. Ritchie, and this is what she said.
It was first thought of as a psychological disorder, a pure psychological disorder. But as we learn more about our bodies and our brains, there are more connections between the physical and the psychological parts of that. And so, for example, some people who have PTSD have a great deal of problems eating or swallowing, and there's anxiety that goes with it. So it's not a simple disorder. It's got many different forms to it. But what's universal to all of them is it follows trauma, and usually severe trauma. In 1980, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which you hear referred to as a DSM, talked about post-traumatic stress disorder. And at that time, we had both acute stress disorder, what happened right away after a trauma, and post-traumatic, which back then they conceived as being a month or more after the trauma. Now we don't worry so much about the different timing, but the names reflect our understanding of the cause of the disorder. It also reflects some understanding about treatment. So World War I, we called it shell shock because we thought it was due to the concussion and their artillery of the big guns exploding. And so shell shock would be a logical name. And we also learned through different wars that it was related to being tired and having seen a lot of combat. So World War II, battle fatigue. And part of the expectation in that name was that if you got somebody tired and fatigued, you could also bring them back by having them have some sleep, some rest, with an expectation of return to treatment. And that's how it was treated in World War II. I'd like to emphasize that World War I and World War II were very different wars than the long wars we've had since 9/11, and that is part of it, too. Now we have people who are going back into combat for many years, a year in Iraq, back in the States, back to Afghanistan, back and forth again. And we've also found that a lot in the way of new treatments that we didn't have back in World War I or World War II. War is dirty not only in the sort of sense of tricks being played on people, but also environmentally dirty. And if you remember the first Gulf War back in 1990 and Gulf War Syndrome, that was another name for not quite the exact same symptoms. It was often had rashes and nerve ailments, headaches and migraines. And it was believed that they were due to environmental toxic exposures, such as nerve agent or sand or oil well fires, and that those were the things that precipitated the Gulf War illness, along with the stress of being at war. A lot has changed. One thing that hasn't changed very much is the human mind. And so we have all these sophisticated technologies, but it's as humans, it's only been 100 years since the first World War I. So there's things that have changed. Our reaction to war, the psychological trauma, has continued.
Dr. Ritchie also wanted to emphasize that symptoms of PTSD vary from person to person, can be temporary or lasting, and can often be treated.
One of the points this is a good chance to make here is that there can be reasonable accommodations for people with PTSD. It doesn't mean that they can't work in those environments, but often they need to have, for example, if they're in an office, maybe they need to have a soundproof area for their office so that you can minimize the bang doors. So we think of it in terms of combat veterans, but many other populations do as well. Sexual assault victims are one of the bigger populations, and we see that in both women and men who have been sexually assaulted. Another is survivors of disasters, say after 9/11, If you watch the trade towers fall, you may have PTSD. Other circumstances, victims of torture, earthquakes. Another piece that's important to recognize is there's a whole range of severity. You can have some symptoms such as nightmares, which are very common and self-limited and don't require treatment, or you can be so incapacitated, unable to get out of your house, for example, because it's so scary out there. And that comes to treatment. The mild versions usually go away on their own, but the more severe versions do require treatment. Some people call PTSD the common cold of psychiatry. Again, it can range from something mild and self-limited to something that turns into bronchitis and pneumonia and needs treatment.
Since post-traumatic stress varies from person to person and can often be mislabeled by the media, we asked Dr. Ritchie to share some of the misconceptions we may have about post-traumatic stress and how it's viewed.
So the big misconception is that if you have PTSD, you're a ticking time bomb, you're going to become violent. And that's a real problem because veterans want to come back and reintegrate. And if they have that stigma of folks being fearful about them, then that's not particularly helpful. And some of the symptoms I mentioned of PTSD, things like nightmares and intrusive thoughts, that's not going to be a ticking time bomb. That's going to make the person unpleasant or to themselves and possibly unpleasant to others if they're irritable.
As Dr. Ritchie mentioned, there are many experiences, traumas, and other ordeals that can cause someone to have to deal with post-traumatic stress. Fortunately, people can continue to live normal lives, and we are making great strides in providing care, therapy, and assistance to people with post-traumatic stress. She shared some of the things that we're doing now to help those with post-traumatic stress find hope and healing.
I'd like to think about treatment and talk to patients about treatment in three buckets. And the three buckets are medication, talking therapy, and everything else. And the everything else list is pretty large and interesting. I'll go back to the medication. There are medications which are FDA, Food and Drug Administration, approved for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. The two medications there are the mild antidepressants, paroxetine or Paxil, sertraline or Zoloft. However, a number of other medications are used for the treatment. Many of these are used, quote, off-label, but they can be fairly effective. For example, there's a blood pressure medication called Prazosin that is very useful for diminishing nightmares. And there's other of the mild antidepressants, so-called SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, that are useful for post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm a psychiatrist, so that's what I do. I do medications. But I'm also well aware that many people don't respond well to these medications and or have side effects. And the most troubling side effects are the sexual side effects. And some of the medications can cause sedation and weight gain. So while medications can be very useful and have been found in randomized controlled trials to be useful, they're not for everybody. So the second bucket is the psychotherapy bucket. That's the talking therapy. Talking therapies, there's a number of them. We usually use what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive processing therapy. Another one is exposure therapy. And these also work in trials, but people also have problems with some of these, especially the ones that involve the reliving or the retelling of the trauma that happened. And so some people do well with these therapies while others don't tolerate them. And that takes me to bucket number three, which is the everything else bucket. And these include a number of things that we find very promising but don't yet have the evidence base. Acupuncture, for example, we've known for a while it helps with pain. It also diminishes symptoms of PTSD in some people. Meditation, yoga, the sequences that help you calm down your brain, help you focus, also help with symptoms of PTSD. There's a lot of work being done with animals, especially dogs and horses. And some people who won't talk to another human being, much less a therapist, about what happened may find that grooming an animal's mane or taking your dog for a walk or training your dog are very helpful to self-soothe. Another One that I always recommend is exercise. Exercise helps you regulate your neurotransmitters, which are essentially out of control. And then there's some new ones that are exciting that you're hearing about. Some people are interested in the medical use of marijuana, which I don't think we know about enough about yet to prescribe, but certainly I have had many veterans who say marijuana helps their symptoms. So again, the big lumping, the three buckets, medication, psychotherapy, and everything else. And what I do is I recommend that people work with their physician or their psychologist and pick out what therapy is good for them or what therapy is, because often a combination. As one Marine told me, yoga calms down my hot brain so that then I can do the talking therapies. And so it really should be an exercise in communication between the therapist and the patient, and not just have, as you've often heard, you know, my doctor just threw a bunch of pills at me.
Finally, we mentioned to Dr. Ritchie that James's friend Cody had said that James was more likely to deal with traumatic experiences on his own, and she shared why this is fairly common with our veterans.
Unfortunately, in the military, mental health is often seen as a punitive experience. People may go to mental health when they're being discharged from the military for breaking some rules or having a DWI offense. And so people don't want to go see mental health, especially in the military, because they're worried about their careers. And that carries over to the VA administration. Young men and young women, who want to go see a doctor unless you really have to? The barriers to treatment are quite large. And it's not that the VA and other places are trying to put up barriers, but it's often just hard to get there. And then I mentioned, and I'd like to emphasize this a little bit more, that people don't necessarily want to talk about what happened. Who want to talk about seeing their best friend's head get blown off over and over again? Unfortunately, there's no easy Band-Aid for this. This isn't something that you can say, well, just talk to him in the morning and all will be better. And it's also often hard to get people into treatment, and that's often a complicated negotiation. It's usually best if you have a military family member with PTSD that you try to get him with other military or veterans, because he or she is much more likely to share with other people who have been there, done that, got the t-shirt.
So what happened to James Lidcutt after he went out with friends on November 3rd, 2018? We know that he had gone out with his roommate Mai and some acquaintances, and that they eventually got separated. He was last seen on surveillance video at 1:13 a.m. walking behind the Pickle Tavern, in the direction of a bike path. Bouncers at this bar say they denied entry because he was intoxicated. One strange thing is that it appears that his phone was still on at 8:25 p.m., more than 19 hours later. The focus of the searches for James have been on the Chippewa River, but they've all turned up empty. No trace of James, including his cell phone or wallet, have ever been found. Did James end up in the river and just hasn't been found? Or did something far more sinister happen to James? Why did his roommate Mai move out several months later and stop talking to James' sister Kristen? At the time of his disappearance, James Lidcutt was 28 years old, had brown hair, brown eyes, and was approximately 5'7" tall, and weighed about 170 pounds. He was last seen wearing a maroon t-shirt, jeans with tears at the knee, and a baseball cap. If you have any information about the disappearance of James Lidcutt, please contact the Eau Claire Police Department at 715-839-4972. You can follow James's story on Facebook at Bring James Home.
Part of me some days thinks that he's kidnapped, because it's like, if he was wearing a hat or something, wouldn't you find at least some piece of him? But then again, you know, he could have in the water. Though I've seen him drunk before, like where I was his DD driver, and he was fine. He just wanted to go home, and I was told that they were in a party bus. So it's like they pretty much, instead of looking for him when they were all together, they pretty much, instead of looking for him and leaving together, they kind of just left him behind. you should make sure that your party is together. How is he going to get back home? His vehicle isn't with him. I mean...
You know, I've talked to a lot of people about this, as friends, and everybody said James didn't have any enemies. So, I have to believe that. I've never seen, you know, I've never seen a side of James where I would think he would, you know, have enemies. So and my brother said he never had any enemies, so I have to believe that James didn't have any enemies. You know, that's part of the mystery, I guess.
That brings us to the end of episode 176. I'd like to thank everyone who took the time to speak with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. One quick note is that next week and beyond, we are moving the episode release time from 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to first thing Monday morning, but you will have the episode available for your Monday commutes. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Oregon. Thanks for listening.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid. We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.